officially become the presumptive Democratic nominee will campaign next week in battleground states with her running mate. Question is, who will be her running mate?
Harris expected to announce her running mate any day. Those who've been thoroughly vetted for the ticket include hired astronaut Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabby Giffords, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, a retired school teacher and former congressman, and popular Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. Like Harris, a former prosecutor. Shapiro, sources tell me, cleared his schedule this weekend and is one of the contenders meeting with Harris.
That's ABC's Selena Wang. The U.S. military deployed an additional fighter squadron to the Middle East as retaliation against Israel's expected after the recent killings of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin canceled a plea deal for the three men accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. This is ABC News. Sentencing is set for President Biden's son, Hunter, who was convicted of three felony gun charges in June. That sentencing date, November 13. The president has said he would not consider a pardon for his son, who was convicted of lying on a form about his drug use when he purchased a gun. It's the end of the road for Aerosmith, cutting short its final tour because of singer Steven Tyler's vocal issues.
No more singing at concerts with Steven Tyler. Aerosmith announcing on social media that its touring days are over, saying the 76-year-old Tyler has been struggling for months to get his voice in shape following a vocal injury which had paused their Peace Out Farewell tour. But despite having the best medical team, a full recovery is impossible, and they made what they call a heartbreaking but necessary decision to retire from the road. The post closes with a final thank you to fans, saying, quote, "Play our music loud, now and always. Dream on. You've made our dreams come true." Jason Athenson, ABC News, Hollywood.
Brian Clark, ABC News.
This history can't be denied. Wisconsin is the home of the hamburger. About 30 minutes west of Green Bay, you'll find the city of Seymour, where in the 1880s, young Charlie Nagreen pushed his food cart to the fair. The 15-year-old planned to sell round balls of beef to visitors, but it didn't quite catch on. Can you guess the surprising reason why? The answer's coming up. Every summer, the home of the hamburger celebrates its history in a huge way with Burger Fest in Seymour. There's a 200-pound burger on the grill, a bun, run, ketchup slide, and of course, a burger-eating contest. So did you guess why Charlie's first beef recipe didn't work out? Well, as the story goes, visitors to the fair wanted to walk around. Charlie realized he needed to smash his beef ball between two pieces of bread to be able to eat it on the go. Charlie's hamburger, a huge success, making Seymour the home of the hamburger, a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. While violent crimes like homicide are on the decline in the U.S., advocates say murder rates are still too high. Will Waukee reports.
Violent crime rates in major U.S. cities are continuing to fall from the heights they reached during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to a new report from the Council on Criminal Justice. But advocates say there's still a lot of work to do to control crime, especially gun deaths. Charles Crest is with the group Stop the Violence 757.
One is too many for me. So what they're saying in the numbers, yes, we don't have 10 anymore, but we still have an astronomical number that it's almost week to week. We're losing someone between the ages of 30 to 15.
Nationally, the murder rate rose 30% between 2019 and 2020, the largest single year increase in more than a century. It's taken until this year for homicides to drop below pandemic levels. The data comes from about 30 cities of various sizes, and it also showed drops in robberies, aggravated assault, and domestic violence cases. Ernesto Lopez with the Council on Criminal Justice says the results are encouraging, but limited considering the variation city to city and lack of communities providing accurate numbers.
Homicide is influenced by a lot of local factors. In fact, we know that most violence can be isolated to specific neighborhoods within a city, so that it's essential for leaders to take time to analyze and fully understand local crime patterns while having a view towards more national trends.
I'm Will Waukee. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Northern Wisconsin forecast. I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine and highs in the low 80s today. For tonight, some scattered storms and a low of 59. Mostly sunny, 78 for Sunday. An afternoon storm is possible. For Monday, showers are likely. We'll have a high near 70 degrees. Tuesday, 74.
It's 57 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll be looking back at the weekend highlights from the Paris Olympic Games and talking about the new Democratic presidential ticket.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matinee on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our weekly weekend review of all things related to justice and government and the rule of law in Wisconsin, in America, and sometimes across the globe. Delighted to have you with me this weekend for that review, along with my terrific producer, Max, here in the studios of Civic Media. Always, always taking your phone calls, your questions, your inquiries about our syllabus. That telephone number, 844-967-2789. And Max always reminds me, too, that you can drop a note to us, an inquiry, a question on the Civic Media app, taking all of that input, making you a part of our discussion about law and government and the aspiration for justice. Once again, honored you're spending some time with Max and me talking about all of those issues on this, the first weekend of August 2024. Our name, as always, comes from the Latin, amicus, meaning friend, an individual, an organization, some sort of entity that somehow assists in understanding, in appreciation, assessment of some relevant issues that need to be resolved, need to be understood as a part of our community engagement. And that's where we take our name, hopefully providing some assistance as a friend of the community, understanding those issues in law and justice and the promotion of the rule of law. Always premised too, always premised as well upon rule of law events, current events that happened. And this weekend is no exception. Lots and lots of things. Many of these news stories breaking just in the past 24 hours or so that animate our syllabus, our agenda for this weekend's broadcast of Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and I'm your host for this hour, this first hour on our broadcast, and also then the second hour, also covering those major issues and inviting, as always, your questions or inquiries about them. Let's talk about what is on our agenda, our ambitious but achievable agenda for this weekend's presentation program, our discussion here on Amicus Law Review. We are going to be revisiting a couple of issues that we have talked about in the past, principally because they have been resurrected and renewed just in recent days. A lot of focus, a huge amount of focus, just in the past 4 to 5 days on the Supreme Court once again. We know, based upon our previous discussions, that the 9 justices of our highest court have not gone away for the summer. They're still there. They're still entertaining cases, still animating what will be on the docket for the next term. But the Supreme Court has also been the subject of a lot of news attention just this past week, having to do with, yes, that's right, the R word, reform. The president has proposed some reforms. There are actions in the legislative branch in both the House and the Senate. Lots and lots of discussion out there, including some statements made by one of the associate justices, her name, Elena Kagan. And she is talking about the importance of an ethics code and, yes, indeed, a mechanism for enforcing it, which has always been the focus of a lot of that debate about whether or not the Supreme Court should have an ethics code, and if so, what its content should be, and specifically, who decides who decides how to enforce that code? Elena Kagan just this past week talking a lot about that. And then we've got the introduction of legislation, both on the House side and also the Senate, proposing some significant changes in the wake principally of that catastrophic recent decision by the Supreme Court on July 1 that announced that presidents are in fact immune from certain kinds of criminal activity in which they might engage while they're in the Oval Office. A stunning piece of judicial statement, and the Congress is responding to it, as is the president. Lots of proposals out there. We're going to talk about those on our broadcast this weekend and then talk about the realities of this, how it is these kinds of things get accomplished, how it is that the community can become engaged in attempting to move forward on what should be more than just proposals, but things to enact in our national life and experience. A couple of other things coming out of very recent news that are also going to be the subjects of our attention in this weekend broadcast here on Amicus, a Law Review. One of them coming out of this bombshell reporting from the Washington Post, extensive reporting indicating that although there have been some tendrils about this story in the past, indicating, however, that Egypt, and in particular the leader in Egypt, we'll talk about him, may in fact have negotiated a method for providing as much as $10 million for then presidential candidate Donald Trump as a part of his campaign in 2016, a huge bombshell report on whether or not the Egyptian government and its leader in particular provided millions of dollars to the Trump campaign, Donald Trump taking that money allegedly, purportedly, perhaps, as a part of his campaign. And if so, a plain, unmistakable violation of the federal criminal law that prohibits campaign entities from taking monies from foreign governments. We're going to talk in some detail about this major reporting coming out of the Washington Post just in the past 24 to 36 hours. The reports on investigation that was afoot at the same time that the Bob Mueller investigation was underway, focusing upon Russian interference in the 2016 election. At the same time, entertaining this related but separate focus having to do with Egyptian involvement in that election, specifically, arguably, purportedly, allegedly, a payment from Egypt into that Trump campaign to support the campaign at a time when it needed financing. And then the reason why this case, this instance, this news event is so very important, further reporting on what happened. What happened to this particular investigation? Fairly clear, if not completely clear, from the reporting again provided by the Washington Post, which has been examining, looking at documents, talking to many people for a long period of time. Fairly clear that under the direction and supervision of, yes, that's right, former Attorney General Bill Barr, the entire investigation was dropped, was stopped, was stymied, even though investigators and attorneys for the Department of Justice interested in pursuing it further, obviously not yet in the public domain at that time. But based upon the decision apparently by our former Attorney General and at least one of the U.S. attorneys sitting in the District of Columbia, a decision to bring that investigation to a close, presumably on the basis that in their view, there was not a sufficient ground upon which to pursue it further. We'll talk about that. This story is not going away. It is a bombshell in terms of past conduct. One of the footnotes is because of the antiquity of all of this, unlikely that it can be prosecuted now, long after the statute of limitations. Although, given the fact that this may have other tendrils out there, including finance aspects beyond just campaign violations, arguably some look at this again. Note specifically that the statute of limitations probably expired sometime in 2022. That was when the present attorney general was in place, his name Merrick Garland. We'll talk about all that. We'll talk here on Amicus, a Law Review, about the rule of law implications of that story breaking now in the midst of an election campaign two terms later in 2024, the implications of what Donald Trump and the campaign may have done in 2016 into 2017 at that time, a case that probably will not be prosecuted, but reasons for Americans to be concerned about it, focusing upon it, and understanding what our government leadership at the Department of Justice level has done and did not do again, a significant reflection into what the Supreme Court recently did. And that is saying that with respect to engagements with the Department of Justice, complete immunity for a president at that time, and presumably for the present time as well. And finally, in terms of major news stories coming up in this weekend's edition of Amicus Law Review, I'm going to talk about what happened coming out of the Guantanamo Bay venue, this place where at least three plotters in the 9/11 disaster, the conspiracy to not only undermine our nation, but to engage in this horrific terrorist activity, taking the lives of nearly 3,000 people in New York, at the Pentagon in Pennsylvania. Some of those plotters were pleading guilty earlier in this week, just a couple of days ago, based upon an arrangement set forth by the military attorneys in that case. A significant turnaround just last night when the defense secretary weighed in, presumably for the first time, his name, of course, Lloyd Austin, and he reasserted his direct oversight in the case and effectively put an end to that deal that would have prevented the death penalty from being imposed upon at least these three plotters, instead sending this all back for presumably further criminal pretrial litigation and further look at what happens next. We're going to talk about what all of this means, the significant reversal inside the Department of Defense. Again, this is a military proceeding right now. We'll talk a little bit, too, about the Justice Department implications for this as well. The reasons why it's there, the reasons why this was going ahead toward resolution, presumably the reasons why the defense secretary has decided not to pursue that and instead to send this all back into the military court and attempt, presumably, for some additional negotiation, presumably some additional litigation that ultimately will lead to some disposition of this. The big question, when? When, after more than 20 years of engagement, when does this get resolved? No doubt the events, the rule of law, the justice-related events of just this past week, postpone that day, and make fairly clear that it will be no time soon when those particular defendants are brought to what we can generally call justice in America. All of that on our agenda. And then we're going to turn again to some of the lower courts here in the United States of America. Going to be spending some time talking about what not the Supreme Court has done, but some lower courts, the appellate courts, and in particular focusing upon, yes, that's right, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, that Fifth Circuit that has generated in this past term almost more cases for the Supreme Court than any other circuit. The Ninth Circuit outbid it, if you will, by just a couple of cases, about 10 cases altogether coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals going up to the Supreme Court. And the Fifth Circuit sort of at it again, if you will, in connection with issuing some major decisions about phone service access for low-income families, and also a major voting rights case, a major voting rights case in which the Fifth Circuit overturned its own precedent and found setting back voting rights again, in, at least in that circuit, by years and by great dimensions, a major case determining that, in fact, the plaintiffs cannot be aggregated according to their particular focus as they go ahead in prosecuting that case. We're going to talk about all of that coming up this weekend as we review all of this. Stay with us for Amicus, a law review and the discussion that goes along with it.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Well, hi there. It's the fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke bringing you the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings right here on WBZH. It's not just for farmers. It's for anybody that loves food. Tune in 5 a.m. on the Buzz of the North, 910 a.m. Hayward.
Earl Ingram.
Let's go to Landfall, Cunnamawog.
I met Kamala, and she's super intelligent. She will select people who are competent in their field.
So, Sandy, you don't hear those words when it comes to the other guy.
Well, he's going to select loyal people. Project 2025 seems to diminish the notion that there needs to be competence in government.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this hour and also next hour. Thank you for joining me and my terrific producer, Max. We are taking, as always, your questions and your inquiries. That number, 844-967-2789. Here are the broadcast studios of Civic Media. And also, Max is terrific at identifying for me and for all of us your questions, your inquiries on the Civic Media app. So join us, be a part of our discussion about all of these things related to the rule of law and government and justice in our nation. And this weekend, also a bit beyond, the ways in which other places affect litigation and affect justice here in America. Let's begin, as we often do, with focus at this time of year upon our United States Supreme Court. Having recently decided just about 60 major cases, we spent a lot of time in recent broadcasts talking all about those. Even as the Supreme Court begins to fill up its docket for the coming year, the reality is the Supreme Court remains very much in the eye, the attention of our nation. Why? Because as predicted just this past week, the President of the United States of America, the executive branch, interesting civics issue, proposing changes for another branch, that's the judicial branch. And so what does President Joe Biden announce on Monday of this past week? He is in Austin, Texas. He was presenting this as a part of his acknowledgement and his focus on the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. And he's at the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library and Museum in Austin, Texas. And he uses this opportunity of that major anniversary to talk about the need for reform, using the R word with a capital R, to change the ways in which the Supreme Court is operating and functioning here in 2024. In previous years, obviously animating what he's proposing for the future. What in particular does he say? He calls the Supreme Court an extreme and unchecked court that's engaging in an agenda that is not consistent, he says, with the will and the purpose of the American people, and focusing in particular upon these decisions having to do with immunity and having to do with other rulings that suggest clearly that the Supreme Court is not following its own self-adopted principles, not a code, but self-adopted principles. The president says that, folks, he says, just imagine what a president could do, trampling civil rights and liberties given such immunity. He's talking about that case issued by the Supreme Court on July 1, finding that the executive branch, at least the president himself, herself, has immunity for certain kinds of crimes that can be committed in the White House. He says they're serious, man. They're planning another onslaught attacking civil rights in America. That's classic Joe Biden in Austin just this past week. And so what specifically is he proposing? Very much predicted. He has signaled this previously. Let's talk first about what he is not proposing, because that is not a part of his agenda. His proposal does not include an increase in the numbers of Supreme Court justices. He has previously said in other settings he's not favoring that. He feels that that is much too political. And so once again, did not go down that road this past week saying, I'm going to so-called pack the Supreme Court. I'm not going to increase, or at least try to increase, the number of Supreme Court justices, because, again, he feels that that would be viewed as too partisan. And so this issue about numbers of Supreme Court justices, not, at least with respect to the president's proposal, not on the agenda. Now, we know that the numbers of Supreme Court justices can indeed be increased. That can be done legislatively. You don't need a constitutional amendment to accomplish that. The legislature indeed has made changes in the numbers. We are at 9 right now. That's been the case since the late 19th century, but it's been as low as 5. And the legislature, our Congress, has changed that number from time to time. And so you could do that legislatively. Of course, what you need is plainly both houses of the Congress to adopt just that kind of a change. unlikely that would happen in any event, but it's not a part of the proposal. And it is also not a part, seemingly, of the proposals coming out of the legislature either, although plainly is still some animation for numbers. But that putting that aside, the president did articulate three other areas in which he wants to pursue on behalf of the American people. These changes will affect dramatically the ways in which our Supreme Court does its business. One, at the top of the list, perhaps, this idea of an ethics code. The suggestion, plainly not new to the president of the United States of America. We have talked about this particular history in the past. The notion that an ethics code has been the subject of a huge amount of debate. You may recall well that in the fall of last year, Senator Dick Durbin, who is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, invited the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, his name is John Roberts, to come to that Senate Judiciary Committee and talk about the need for an ethics code. What, in the wake of the actions reported activities by at least two justices, Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, accepting gifts, various vacation opportunities, vehicles, other things, otherwise engaging in activities involving income and even presiding in cases in which they themselves have personal interests, all of those kinds of things, many, many things out there wrapped up into this concern about whether or not our Supreme Court is following an ethics code. The Senate Judiciary Committee inviting the Chief Justice to come over to the Congress and testify about that. Chief Justice John Roberts declining that opportunity and instead, in November of last year, putting together what really is an amalgam of standards and principles that have been out there for a long period of time and saying, here is our code. This is what we're going to follow. It is aspirational. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's not an enforceable code. It's not a code that would address these kinds of things that have been in the attention of the American people coming out of specifically the activities of Alito and Thomas, but others as well. There's some other concerns on the bench too. And so that went nowhere. The prospect of the legislature at that time pursuing that engagement directly with the Chief Justice instead saying, here's our code of ethics. And that's where it pretty much was left, although discussion continued. And again, the issue was enforceability. What could possibly be done to enforce such a code? Because indeed, rules without enforcement are not meaningful. And so the president just this past week announces not only a set of principles pretty much consistent with what the Supreme Court has said they embrace, but also enforcing and proposing the enforcement of it through mechanisms that make it real. And that is a key portion of what the president has proposed just this past week. Now, significantly, in the category of this first item among the president's several proposals for Supreme Court reform, we also get some commentary from justices themselves. We know the Chief Justice has not been supportive of a legislatively imposed ethics code. That plainly is what the president is now proposing formally. It plainly is what others have proposed. And indeed, just this past week, appearing in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as you know, the Ninth Circuit heard from Elena Kagan, who talks about the fact that, yes, indeed, she feels that this so-called amalgam of standards and practices announced by the Chief Justice in November are good things, but without enforcement. And she said this set of rules does not have enforcement. And as we recall from our previous discussions on this very broadcast, she says, you know what? I think that the Chief Justice should form a committee of lower court judges, district court judges, appeals court judges, all of them proposed to enforce this particular code of ethics. And so all of that wrapped up inside these proposals to think about ethics when it comes to the Supreme Court. We're going to continue and talk more about the president's proposals, what Supreme Court members have said about them, and the legislative response as well.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Vice President Kamala Harris, now with enough delegates to officially become the presumptive Democratic nominee, will campaign next week in battleground states with her running mate. Question is,
who will be her running mate.
Harris expected to announce her running mate any day. Those who've been thoroughly vetted for the ticket include hired astronaut Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabby Giffords, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, a retired school teacher and former congressman, and popular Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, like Harris, a former prosecutor. Shapiro, sources tell me, cleared his schedule this weekend and is one of the contenders meeting with Harris.
That's ABC's Selena Wang. The U.S. military deployed an additional fighter squad to the Middle East as retaliation against Israel's expected after the recent killings of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin canceled a plea deal for the three men accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
It's the Packers family night.
Hi,
I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers holding their annual practice inside Lambeau Field. This is their 24th year, and tonight is a sellout. Up to 81,000 fans expected to attend. Head coach Matt LaFleur.
Having that many fans come out, I think it naturally just ups the urgency. It feels truly like a preseason game.
Baseball, the Brewers with an 8-3 win over the Nationals in Washington, D.C. It was the first time pitching in a Brewers uniform for Frankie Montas, traded to Milwaukee from the Reds before the deadline. Now, he gave up those three runs, but went five innings and was asked, what was his mindset? And he said, you know, with guys like Bryce Terang in the infield.
Just trying to throw strikes. You know, these guys have great defense. They play great defense, you know, so I was just trying to make it hit the ball, you know. But yeah, just trying to attack and throw strikes.
Montrez becomes the 17th pitcher to start a game for the Crew this season, which ties the record set in 1969 by the Seattle Pilots, who became the Milwaukee Brewers the following season. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Northern Wisconsin forecast. I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine and highs in the low 80s today. For tonight, some scattered storms and a low of 59. Mostly sunny, 78 for Sunday. An afternoon storm is possible. For Monday, showers are likely. We'll have a high near 70 degrees. Tuesday, 74.
It's 64 at our studios.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet neighborhood streets. It's more likely to kill you than a shark and more terrifying than the biggest snake. Distracted driving claims lives every day. Every notification, swipe, social post, video, or selfie while driving risks your life. So while you might think public speaking or the zombie apocalypse is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward. Don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
Speaking of J.D. Vance, if you're watching on the stream, you can see behind me what we're now calling the J.D. Vance couch. There are some reports that back in the day, during the frat days of J.D. Vance, he may have gotten intimate with a couch. So.
You know, I've slept on that couch a few times, but I can't say I've slept with that couch, and nor do I plan to.
No.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Nair on air.
We were talking about Donald Trump. He also said that he knows how to correctly pronounce Kamala Harris's name. He just chooses not to. And so I think that kind of opens it up for us to take some liberties.
Yeah. What would be your fix to the name?
Dave from New Berlin texting in Conald.
Conald.
Dump. Also, Calvin's was Donald Trump.
Who said there's a correct one?
Except, like, it's pronounced Kamala.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us. Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in to the next Devil's Advocates radio show. It's the Kamala Pixar Vice President Edition. We'll introduce you to the candidate Devil's Advocates Radio.
The Devil's Advocates. Weekdays 4 till 6.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour as well here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media talking about this new major news breaking in and outside of all three branches of our federal government this past week. Terrific civics issues for the middle of the summer of 2024 having to do with Supreme Court reform proposals for that, pushback on it, and argument about where this goes in the future. Spent a little bit of time in our first segments talking about this proposal coming from the president for the establishment of a clear and significantly enforceable code of ethics. Obviously, the president proposes that and endorses that. Members of Congress, not universally, but members of Congress, certainly in the Senate and some of them in the House of Representatives as well, similarly endorse that. We've got Supreme Court justices like Elena Kagan who similarly say, yes, a good idea, but needing enforcement, proposing this notion that lower federal court judges would be the ones to decide on, say, for example, recusals and other things related to the conduct of Supreme Court justices. We know in the past 2 years alone that Clarence Thomas, embroiled in these ethical concerns, failing to disclose gifts and luxury trips bestowed upon him by a billionaire benefactor, Harlan Crow. Justice Samuel Alito, likewise, facing a number of issues related to a trip he took, but also the scrutiny about why some flags associated with the January 6th, 2021 attack on our Capitol were flying outside his homes. All of those kinds of things and more prompting this focus upon an ethics code. A lot of debate about whether or not the legislature can impose an ethics code upon another branch of government. It's part of a check and balance. We've got Sam Alito saying you can't, saying there's no such thing in the Constitution. No capacity whatsoever, he told the Wall Street Journal a number of months ago. No authority whatsoever for the Congress to regulate the Supreme Court in this area. So he rejects this notion completely, giving rise to more debate on the ethics issue. There is more to this package, and that goes specifically to the issue of term limits. We know as well that this has been a part of our discussion about whether or not this notion of lifetime tenure should continue as we go into the middle portion and beyond that of the 21st century. Now, lifetime tenure is the way that the Constitution has been interpreted since the time of its writing. Indeed, our founding fathers anticipated, as we know from the Federalist Papers, that federal judges, not just Supreme Court justices, but other judges that would be created, those positions created by the legislature, all of them would be imposed, they would be invested, rather, with lifetime tenure based upon their own engagement and activities while they're engaging in good behavior is the way the Constitution anticipates their activity and establishes that for all of the federal judges. Lifetime tenure, that is the interpretation given that good behavior language inside the Constitution. So what is the proposal out here? Well, the proposal from the president and also echoed by at least one, if not more, senators in the United States Senate. One of them is Sheldon Whitehouse. He's a senator from Rhode Island, a very strong advocate, also on the Senate Judiciary Committee, also advocating for term limits. The concept would be an 18-year term limit. You become a Supreme Court justice, and you are there deciding cases in the normal course for 18 years. And after that term, you do not lose your title. You don't lose your position as a Supreme Court justice. You rather take upon sort of an emeritus status. You do other things on behalf of the court. You may, for example, preside over appellate proceedings in some of the many appeals courts in our nation. Maybe you try some cases in some of the federal courts. Do other things related to the administration of justice as the Chief Justice may direct, all those kinds of things, possibilities. You would not be a part of the 9-member panel that decides the core cases that come up from the courts of appeals to the Supreme Court. You would have some involvement under these proposals for those cases that involve original jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction, as it's described in the Supreme Court, in the Constitution of the United States of America, establishes that the Supreme Court can hear cases involving disputes between the states and other kinds of things, other kinds of matters that likewise are momentous and significant for our nation. Those kinds of cases, the so-called emeritus justices, would still be engaged in. But for the most part, after 18 years not deciding these cases and significantly creating then vacancies when Supreme Court justices, having reached that landmark stage in their tenure, as they move on, new vacancies are created, and therefore presidents on a fairly regular basis would be appointing new justices. That's a proposal for term limits. And again, it is an interesting concept, certainly subject to a lot of dispute about whether or not it runs afoul of that good behavior language in the Constitution. An awful lot of people say it's a creative and legal and lawful way of addressing both the longevity of our Supreme Court justices, which we presently have, also ensuring some new life on the bench, and doing all that without violating the language, at least as it's interpreted, of the Constitution itself, permitting all those justices to remain justices during their terms of good behavior. That term limit concept also a part of what the president is proposing just this past week, also a part of what is pending in the United States Senate as a part of this attempt to underscore the need for reform in the United States Supreme Court. And then there's another component, a third component of what the president has proposed this past week, and that is related to this major case, this what I've described as this catastrophic case, decided this decision issued on July 1 that finds that there are, in fact, categories of things that a president can do for which he or she cannot be prosecuted criminally. A major case changing the Constitution, proposals by the president and by members of Congress to change things back to the way they were envisioned by our leadership at the time the Constitution was put together. The president in particular says that not only does he support the code of conduct and the term limits, but also said that these systems of mechanisms for the Supreme Court to behave in their common sense reforms that a vast majority of Americans support, among those he identifies an amendment that would curb the court's immunity ruling and would state explicitly in the Constitution that the Constitution, that the law, the supreme law of the land, does not, in fact, confer upon former presidents any immunity from federal criminal indictment or trial or conviction or sentencing. And all of that proposed as a constitutional amendment by the people through the legislature and then by the states. Now, we know that that's no small thing to accomplish. Under the Constitution itself, that decision would be necessarily dependent upon 2/3 votes in both houses of Congress and followed by ratification by 3/4 of the Senate. It is no small lift. It is significant, however, that the president is proposing a constitutional amendment in this area. Why? Because he feels that this immunity issue, the thing that the Supreme Court got so very wrong on July 1 of this year, has got to be ensconced, got to be incorporated into our Constitution as a fundamental concept. Now, there are other activities, other engagements on this very issue that take a different approach, even while expressing outrage about the decision itself. We know that in the United States Senate, Chuck Schumer, who is the majority leader there, has introduced something called the No Kings Act. The No Kings Act, that takes its name principally from the dissenting opinion issued by Sonia Sotomayor and also joined in by Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan, saying this is craziness. This is inconsistent with our basic tenets of judicial administration and of government operation. Chuck Schumer introduces just this past week the No Kings Act and validating that ruling by declaring that presidents are not immune from criminal law and declaring that only Congress and not the Supreme Court determines who faces federal criminal law. Now, he's saying that because, of course, where do the criminal laws come from in our country? They're passed by the legislature. The House and the Senate pass all of those statutes that are provided to ensure that the rules and regulations are enforced, that the criminal laws are established by our Congress. And so Chuck Schumer says the criminal laws are established that way. We can also say and establish as a piece of legislation the notion that no one is immune. No one is above the law. There are no kings in America, including the president of the United States of America. His proposal, which again, in theory, is consistent with what the president is advocating for, which is an overturning of this immunity decree by the Supreme Court. Chuck Schumer advocating a legislative approach, saying that the Congress can, in fact, change this. And indeed, they can.
in this area, many other areas. They can affect what's called a congressional fix. They could do it in many other areas as well. Environment and voting rights, very notably. Campaign finance, all those kinds of things that have been the subject of Supreme Court cases in the past. All of those can be fixed by the Congress. And that's precisely what Chuck Schumer is advancing and proposing with his legislation just this past week. Interestingly, on the House side, there is also a representative. His name is Joseph Morrell. He comes from New York. He has introduced, consistent with the president's plan, a constitutional amendment that, again, seeks to undo that Supreme Court ruling that former presidents enjoy a presumption of criminal immunity. Representative Morrell said that earlier this month, the Supreme Court of the United States undermined not just the foundation of our constitutional government, but the foundation of our democracy. At its core, he said, our nation relies on the principle that no American stands above another in the eyes of the law. He is proposing a constitutional amendment for the Constitution itself, putting it inside our very founding document, and goes on to say the American people expect their leaders to be held to the same standard we hold for any member of our community. Presidents, he says, are not monarchy. They are not tyrants and shall not be immune. Again, taking up some of the language that Chuck Schumer in the other branch of the legislature is also articulating, this No Kings Act. We do not have monarchs. We do not have kings. Different approaches to addressing what the Supreme Court has done so badly in terms of restyling, recrafting the way that our government works. The president advocating for a constitutional amendment, at least one member of Congress in the House advocating for the same. And there is support beyond that as well. And we've got Chuck Schumer and others in the Senate advocating for a legislative response. All of that underscoring the significance of this moving forward. No small thing. Again, Dick Durbin and Sheldon Whitehouse on the Senate Judiciary Committee promising more review in the future on all of this. As these issues related to Supreme Court reform in all of these areas, a constitutional or a legislative fix to immunity, an ethics code for the Supreme Court that is enforceable, term limits, which would also be subject to a placement there by the legislature, enactment, if you will, by the president as he or she would create and nominate new nominees for the Supreme Court. All of that now back on the agenda of consideration by our legislature, by our president, and I would recommend by all Americans who are concerned about what the Supreme Court is doing. We have talked a lot about the implications of all of these cases, not just the immunity case, major cases of just this past term and previous terms in the areas of environment and privacy rights and reproductive rights and commerce and education and agriculture, all kinds of things out there the Supreme Court weighs in on a regular basis. If you are concerned about those kinds of things and concerned about the integrity of the highest court in the land as it issues these major opinions, focus on these kinds of things being proposed by the president, by members of the Congress, and indeed by members of the Supreme Court themselves, who acknowledge, like Elena Kagan, that something has to be done. What is the advocacy? The advocacy is to approach your elected representatives in the Congress. You may send letters to your representatives, your senators. You may send letters to others who do not represent you. Specifically, send letters to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his name, Mike Johnson, who has announced very publicly that the president's proposal of just this past week, he said, is dead on arrival. Dead on arrival, he said, as all of this appears in front of the American public. Advocate for change here. Tell the members of Congress, tell others in your community how you feel about this. And again, there is a lot of different proposal out there for many different kinds of things. All of them focusing on the need to address integrity by our Supreme Court. Need to hear from you, the American people, about what should happen next. We'll continue more of this here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
Babes, what are you doing?
What? I'm just mowing the lawn.
No, it's blazing hot and dry out here. Don't you remember? Smokey Bear says,
avoid using power equipment when it's windy or dry.
Where'd you learn this?
Oh, it's on
SmokeyBear.com with many other wildfire prevention tips.
Right. Thanks, Honey Bear.
Because remember, only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus Law Review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Spending a lot of time necessarily talking about the importance of focus on the United States Supreme Court, even during this time period, post-June, post-July, when the Supreme Court is not issuing decisions with the feverish schedule that it has done in recent weeks and, frankly, recent years as well, in the middle of the summer. Nonetheless, still in the news as we think about ways in which addressing the ways in which the Supreme Court operates on a regular basis. Another major, major story coming in the world of rule of law and justice and government justice past week, coming out of Guantanamo Bay. The September 11th plotters of the attack, the terrorist attack of September 11th. We know their names. They're Khalil Sheikh Mohammed, Walib bin Attash, and Mustafa al-Hawassi. Those three, among others, have been in U.S. custody since 2003. They are undeniably accused by our government, not only in public sectors, but also through the military process that they have been subject to in the more than 20 years of their time in custody, with having orchestrated the horrific attacks, the terrorist attacks upon our nation on September 11th of 2001. Those attacks, of course, in New York City, on the Pentagon, and also in Pennsylvania. Fairly clear that all three of them, Khalil Sheikh Mohammed, Walib bin Attash, and Mustafa al-Hawassi, all of them responsible for being the orchestrators, the perpetrators, if you will, of not only the ways in which that was accomplished on September 11th, but the organizers, the people who put this together in the first place on behalf of others out there who were attacking our nation at the time. And so they have been in custody since 2003. During the course of this period, of course, this is another piece of this major case. The three men have been the subject of military proceedings. And those military proceedings have been, while they've been in custody, in Guantanamo Bay. Just this past week, in the middle of the week, these three men accused of plotting those attacks on September 11th, all three of them agreed during the course of the week to plead guilty to conspiracy and to murder charges in exchange for a life sentence for what they did before and certainly on September 11th. And they would do that as a part of a death penalty, taking the death penalty off the table, all that being a part of the continuing prosecution there in Guantanamo Bay. The prosecutors at the time said the deal was meant to bring some finality and some justice to this case. Again, it's been going on for more than 20 years, particularly for the families of the 3,000 people who were killed on that day, specifically about 2,976 people who are identified as having directly lost their lives as a result of the conduct of these three in putting this together. The anticipation was that there would be a 12 to 18 month trial of the charges against these three. And the other significant aspect of this that cannot be overstated is the possibility that the military judge who's presiding over this case, the military judge in particular, whose name is Colonel Matthew McCall, entertaining arguments about throwing out the confessions that these three had made to to the conduct on September 11th and before of that. Why? Based upon the waterboarding and other constitutionally impermissible things to which the CIA subjected them during the 20 years of their captivity, their custody in military custody. We know that following their apprehension overseas as a way of investigating these cases, the CIA did in fact engage in all sorts of behaviors that have since been condemned and not only withdrawn, but clear statements from our Department of Justice, others inside government, that the mechanisms used to obtain these confessions by the three are violative of our Constitution, cannot be embraced. And the question is whether or not in the military setting, those same kinds of conclusions should hold. And so Colonel Matthew McCall, the judge who's presiding over this military tribunal, entertaining testimony for a long period of time, motions, memorandums, lots of argument about whether or not the cases should be disposed of completely based upon the fact that they are premised upon illegal, inappropriate, unconstitutional behavior by the United States of America in doing these waterboarding activities and other things as a result of the investigation, entertaining that notion very seriously and raising the prospect that these military cases against the three could indeed be thrown out if indeed the government acted inappropriately. He has been talking about that. He's been entertaining argument about that for many years now. It remains a very big issue. And so it's in the midst of that that the present prosecutor proposed and indeed seemed to have accomplished this result, not without controversy, that brings all of this to an end, that would provide that the three of them would plead guilty again to conspiracy and murder charges. They would remain in prison for the remainder of their lives, in exchange for which the government would agree to give up an interest in imposing the death penalty upon them. They would serve life in sentence rather than a death penalty judgment. And the question about where they would do that, whether it's in Guantanamo Bay or some other place, not clear yet. All of that put together in the middle of this past week by the prosecutor. Again, all of this inside the prosecution in a military tribunal there in Guantanamo Bay. Significant because it also attracted, of course, the attention of the victim families, some of whom supported this to bring it to some finality as a part of this proposal by the military prosecutor, an opportunity for the three of them to be questioned in court about the motivations, what they did, what they didn't do, an opportunity for the families to present them with questions about their conduct, their activities on September 11th and before that, who it was they were associated with, what they were doing to accomplish this, questions the families wanted answered. That would also be a part, or have been a part, of the proposal to resolve all of this based upon the plea agreement that was in place. And then, last night, the defense secretary, his name Lloyd Austin, assumed what he called direct oversight of the case and effectively put the death penalty back on the table. He basically said that I am rescinding, or at least giving direction to the prosecution there in Guantanamo Bay, that I am now taking control of this case and relieving the senior Defense Department official responsibility for these military commissions, relieving her of the oversight against the case against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his alleged accomplices there for these attacks that were accomplished back in 2001. A very significant event and a development in this that seems to withdraw this entire arrangement put together by the government authorities, the military authorities in Guantanamo Bay. As we continue into our second hour, more analysis of that. What's going on here? And what can we anticipate as those significant cases there continue in Guantanamo Bay here on Amicus, a law review?
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Maggie Dawn.
Coming up, Maggie has an interview with the author of White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo. Probably the most important show you're going to hear in a while. Stay tuned.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
I was in a drive-thru line and forgot to order. I was on the phone, thought I ordered, and just stayed in line and got up to the window. There was no order for me. And I said to the guy, I go, can I just order now? And he was so condescending. And he goes, well, typically what we do, sir, here is we order back at the speaker, and this is where you pick it up. I've never felt so stupid in my entire life.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is the Buzz of the North.
WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.